or Radio Catskill.
WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the Reporters Roundtable. WJFF's Patricia Rubio and four of our local journalists discuss the Sullivan County Legislature, opioids, and cannabis. Catskill's Pride, the folks from the area LGBTQIA+ organization are back, and this time we're discussing sexual health and access to PrEP and HIV treatments. And Ron Bernthal chats with the author of the book, Our National Forest, Maintaining and Protecting the Country's Public Lands for Recreational and Commercial Use. It's from his WJFF podcast, Borders. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. 90 tons of what the U.S. calls lethal aid has arrived in Ukraine amid tensions over Russia's troop buildup along the border. NPR's Rob Schmitz is in Kiev.
It was the first shipment of a recently approved package of U.S. military aid for Ukraine, and it included ammunition for the country's frontline defenders. The delivery followed U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's visit to Kiev this week, where he warned of a tough response if Russia invades Ukraine. Moscow has denied any plans to attack or invade Ukraine. President Joe Biden approved the $200 million security support package in December. On its Facebook site, the U.S. Embassy in Kiev said the U.S. will continue to provide such assistance to support Ukraine's armed forces against Russian aggression. An estimated 100,000 Russian troops are amassed along Ukraine's border. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Kiev.
President Biden is expected to focus on the tensions between Russia and Ukraine today. The White House says he will discuss the situation with his national security team at the Camp David presidential retreat in Maryland. Emergency officials are warning of dangerous travel conditions in the Carolinas and parts of Virginia after another winter storm swept through the region overnight. Nick Della Canal of member station WFAE reports on the second winter storm to hit the East Coast in a week.
The National Weather Service says travel conditions will remain hazardous through the weekend after the storm blanketed parts of the Carolinas and Virginia with dangerous ice and snow. A Delta flight at the Raleigh-Durham Airport skidded off the runway Friday night into some mud. No injuries were reported. The North Carolina Highway Patrol also says a person died after an ambulance hit an icy patch east of Raleigh and ran down an embankment. Emergency crews are working to restore power in many areas, and homeless shelters have expanded capacity for people needing warmth or a place to stay. Officials are asking drivers to stay home and keep roads clear for emergency crews and first responders. For NPR News, I'm Nick Della Canal in Charlotte.
On the West Coast, a wildfire in coastal California has forced evacuations. Officials in Monterey County ordered the evacuations after the fire burning in the Big Sur area grew to more than 250 acres. More aid flights making it into the Pacific Island nation of Tonga. Three from Australia landed there today, said Seselja, is Australia's Pacific Minister.
Of course, those flights have food and water. They have telecommunications equipment, which is very, very important for getting back online and being able to communicate with the world at large, clean-up equipment, medical supplies and the like, PPE.
Seselja, speaking with reporters in Canberra today, saying planes from other nations, including New Zealand and Japan, also flying in aid. The first aid flights arrived Thursday after the main airport runway was cleared of ash following last weekend's eruption of an undersea volcano that set off a tsunami. This is NPR News. The Biden administration says it is suspending dozens of flights from the U.S. to China operated by Chinese airlines. This is in response to China's suspension of flights by U.S. carriers in recent weeks after passengers tested positive for the coronavirus. NPR's John Ruich reports on this latest source of friction between the two countries.
The Department of Transportation says it is suspending 44 flights for now and could take additional action if needed. According to Chinese rules, airlines can be subject to weeks-long suspensions if passengers test positive for COVID up to 7 days after arriving in China. The Department of Transportation says the U.S. government has repeatedly objected to those rules. It says they put undue culpability on carriers and they're inconsistent with an agreement between the two countries on civil air transport. The DOT says China's actions have impaired the operations of Delta, United, and American Airlines. John Ruwitch, NPR News.
The Chinese government is calling the Biden administration's decision to suspend the 44 flights by Chinese carriers very unreasonable. A spokesman for the Chinese embassy in Washington is urging the U.S. to, in his words, stop disrupting and restricting the normal passenger flights, and that China's policy has been applied equally to both Chinese and foreign airlines. Carnival festivities in Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo are being postponed because of the spike in coronavirus cases across Brazil. In a joint statement, the two cities say they will now hold their parades in late April instead of at the end of next month. I'm Giles Snyder. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Every month we bring you the Reporters Roundtable, tackling the topics making news in the region with our local journalists. Today, WJFF's Patricio Rubio chats with Liam Mayo of the River Reporter, Chris Rowley with the Shawangunk Journal, Joseph Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat, and Philip Antuso from the River Newsroom.
Hi, my name is Patricio Rubio, and I'm a producer with WJFF Radio Catskill. Welcome to another edition of the Reporters Roundtable. Thank you so much for joining us, everyone. We have a lot to get to, so let's get straight to it. Here in Sullivan County, we had a big vote of the Sullivan County Legislature for the vote for the chairman. This is to keep Rob Daugherty there for another 2 years. It was a little controversial, and when I say controversial, it was the first time I saw in my experience as a reporter seeing someone voted in and then right after that having been booed. This is something to me was out of the norm. Joe, you were there. What was your take on it?
Sure. So Liam and I were both present in person for that meeting. It was very interesting. So before the meeting even began, even though it was a very chilly day, people were outside putting signs on their cars. And there were some people who were hopeful that there would be new leadership in the legislature that had a drive-by protest at the government center. They just kept circling around with their cars, beeping the horn, and, you know, letting their opinions be heard. We started the legislature meeting, just for those that don't know, the Sullivan County Legislature, they're elected to four-year terms. Halfway through those four-year terms, they have a reorg meeting. They reelect the chair and vice chair. And I had polled all of the legislators, except one of the nine, prior to the vote, which was, and pretty much it was a 4-4 split between Michael Brooks, Nick Salamone, and George Conklin, and obviously Daugherty voting for himself, for in support of himself, for chair. And on the other side, Joe Perillo, District 7 legislator, was going for the chairship. And Louis Alvarez, Ira Steingart, and Nadi Rice supported him in that. I wasn't able to reach Alan Sorensen by press time. But that was sort of the wild card. People were wondering what's Alan going to do because nine seats. So who's that fifth and determining vote going to be? He's District 9. So what they did is they went in reverse order. So he was the first person that had to vote after a nomination was made for Daugherty to be reelected. And he voted in favor of Rob. And, you know, afterwards, yes, some people in attendance, the same folks who were protesting, were also very upset, you know, and making various sounds. But as far as Alan, I reached out to him after the vote. He said the reason that he was supportive of Rob is that he had particular projects in the past that he would bring to other legislative chair people. And those projects kind of fell on deaf ears, and he brought them to Rob, he said. And he said he felt Rob put in the time and effort that helped to bring those projects to fruition, and he has other goals that he has left to accomplish. And he said you need someone that, you know, put in the effort and time that you have confidence will help you accomplish those goals. And That's why he said he voted for Rob. So essentially, in a nutshell, to those listening, Rob Doherty and Michael Brooks were once again, by a 5-4 vote, voted in by the majority of their peers to serve as chair and vice chair of the legislature for the next 2 years until all 9 seats are up for re-election.
All right. Thank you so much for that, Joe. Liam, this was, of course, wasn't the only thing going on in the legislature. Recently, the legislature voted to participate in an opioid settlement. Do you have an update on what's going on with that?
Yeah. So the legislature held an emergency meeting to discuss this opioid settlement during their January 13 meetings. To my knowledge, the emergency meeting was set up during the committee meetings. Like, the committee meeting started around 9. The clerk of the legislature, Anne Marie Martin, was sort of running around setting up this emergency meeting during earlier committee meetings and sent out the notice for the emergency meeting around 10:09, I believe. So it was this somewhat rushed process to talk about this opioid settlement, which is a settlement agreement with the opioid manufacturer Allegrin. It's being done in conjunction with all the counties of New York State. And according to what was discussed at the legislature meetings, Sullivan County is going to get around $377,774 of a overall $125 million suite, with the proportion of that money going to Sullivan County being decided by some kind of objective formula. So the legislature discussed this and eventually decided to sign on to this. So they will be getting that money. But the thing to watch going forward is where that money will end up being spent, I think, because they discussed in the meeting that 50% of that money is guaranteed to go towards opioid programs to combat the opioid epidemic, just based on the terms of the settlement. But the other 50% is unrestricted, so it can theoretically be spent on anything. And legislatures were pretty united in saying this does need to go to opioid programs. This all should go to opioid programs. But there were also sort of specters of what had happened with ARPA money, where the county's last round of ARPA money had not ended up getting spent on public health initiatives. So the legislature said they were going to keep looking into it. County Manager Josh Potosek said that the drug task force is coming up with a list of objectives that they want funded that this money could be used on. So we'll just have to see going forward where this money ends up going and sort of keep an eye on that.
Right. From what I remember, the other funding that you mentioned, I believe, didn't it pay for the new boiler at SUNY Sullivan instead of going to the other things, right?
Yes. Half went to pay for new boilers and, I believe, just overall energy efficiency measures at SUNY Sullivan. And the other half went towards funding road work throughout the county. So not necessarily the kinds of public health initiatives that a lot of public advocates were hoping for.
Now, if we just backtrack a little bit on the vote for Rob, I know since Joe mentioned that you were there in person. So what is sort of your take on what happened there with the vote? And like you mentioned, like, this special meeting for the opioid settlement was done in sort of in a rushed fashion. And it seems that sort of a trend there, almost from my perspective, what I see. But I just want to see, what is your take on what happened with the vote and how everything went down?
Yeah, there was a lot of sentiment on the day that was very, very heightened. As Joe mentioned, there were protesters beforehand. There were protesters during the meeting. And it was sort of the legislature itself. Members of the legislature had sort of choice words for each other during that meeting. I believe in a speech that he gave, a brief speech that he gave after the vote, Rob Doherty said something to the effect that he was an agent for change, that change has its enemies, and that you could know him by his enemies. I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but that's close to what he said. And one of his opposing members, Ira Steingart, leader of the Democratic majority, talked at the end of the meeting about how the public needed to keep showing up, needed to keep holding the legislature accountable, needed to sort of keep doing what they were doing, while members on the legislature would continue to keep fighting for it as well. So with Rob Daugherty becoming chairman again, could have potentially been a time of change. It could have been a time for a little peace to prevail, potentially, but it seems to have only heightened tensions and to have heightened a divide between members of the legislature and between members of the public. And the sort of rushed nature of the opioid settlement isn't necessarily a direct, like, correlation to that. It doesn't just a change in leadership at the county level isn't necessarily going to change everything about how the county works overnight. But I think some people would see that as a sign that there was an opportunity for change with the Rob Daugherty getting reelected that was missed.
And Philip, you're also working at the River Newsroom on the opioid epidemic that's going on in Hudson Valley. What can you tell us from your reporting?
Yeah, so basically we're looking at kind of the same sort of thing that Liam was talking about, but on a little bit of a wider level. So one of the things we learned this week when more details of the executive budget came out is that that budget calls for an increase of $402 million in operating and capital support for the Office of Addiction Services and Supports, to 56% increase in their annual budget. And the funds from the settlement that Liam was talking about, those are being earmarked for investments in new initiatives to combat the opioid crisis. And one thing we're going to kind of be tracking, I think, as that money gets dispersed, is how counties and municipalities decide to use that money. The overall increase in budget funding for the Office of Addiction Services and Supports is also going to create a new division of harm reduction within that office. And one of the things we're looking at there is, as I'm sure several listeners know, a couple months ago in New York City, the city opened two what they call supervised injection sites, which essentially are a safe space for people to inject. And as of January 7th, those sites had reversed 80 overdoses with zero fatalities. And there's a lot of research showing that this is one of the more effective solutions to preventing deaths and reducing the transmission of viruses like HIV and Hep C. And of course, this is badly needed across the state, but especially in Sullivan County, where I think in 2020 the overdose rate was three times what the state's rate was. So we're doing some reporting, basically trying to look at whether the supervised injection site model might be something that makes its way further upstate. I think it's going to be a town by town basis. There's a sort of NIMBY hurdle to overcome with that. There are people who don't exactly want that in their town or in their neighborhood. But there's research shows that not only is it safe, but it actually leads to a decrease in dropped syringes in public places. And similar sites in places like Sydney, Australia, and in Vancouver have seen a decrease in public injection in surrounding communities with no increase in crime or drug trafficking. So that's something we're going to be tracking throughout this year.
Yeah, it'd be very interesting to see if that type of program makes its way up to the Hudson Valley. I know in the past, in some towns, there were talks about having a homeless shelter in their town, and that drew a lot of opposition. So I could just imagine having the thought of having an injection site in a town could upset some people. But like I said, based on the facts and that's coming out, that you're reporting on, you can see an actual benefit to have this in your town, and they have to deal with an opioid problem. We have a huge opioid problem here in Sullivan County. Now, switching topics, the River Newsroom is also covering cannabis. Towns and villages had up to December 31st to choose whether to opt out or opt in for dispensaries. What can you tell us about what the River Newsroom has been doing in covering cannabis?
Yeah, I mean, there's honestly so many ways we could the whole publication could just be a cannabis publication. we could be approaching this. One way we've done it is we had a writer dig into one of these fights that was playing out in municipalities really across the state over whether to opt in or opt out. This writer was looking at the fight in her hometown in Hastings on Hudson, which is down in Westchester County, sort of the southern end of our coverage area. They eventually opted in, but you know, one of the things that has kind of come out from the numbers now that we know the towns that have opted in or opted out is it's pretty hard to draw any kind of conclusion about why a town opted in or out. Like, there's not sort of a neat story to tell around, you know, if you have a certain kind of demographic makeup or if you're rural versus urban or what political leaning you are, whether or not you opted out. Overall, I think towns that went Republican in 2020 were slightly more likely, but that doesn't really scale. Like the counties that were the most Democrat did not have the most opt-ins, for example. It really seems to have broken down on a kind of town by town basis, depending on who the loudest voices in the room were. And one of the things we're looking at, or one of the things the story that we're publishing looks at is this fairly arbitrary deadline, even of December 31st. So in other states that have legalized a recreational cannabis market, they have had this opt-in or opt-out provision that gets kicked down to the municipal level. As far as we can tell, New York is the first one to place a deadline on that decision. And of course, the deadline doesn't work both ways. You can opt out now and then opt in later. Whereas if you opt in, you're in. You know, there are a lot of arguments made for opting out. Some of them, I think, hold more water than others. But one of the ones I think is really kind of compelling is that towns were forced to make this decision without really the details of what the commercial market is going to look like, both dispensaries or consumption lounges, because, you know, the delay in sort of forming the Office of Cannabis Management and staffing it and hammering out all the regulations, that's still being done. So to put this deadline before all of the parameters and particulars are known does seem, you know, like it's putting towns in a tough place, even if by opting out, they're going to end up missing out on revenue.
I attended a public hearing in Fallsburg on cannabis. The town was deciding whether to opt out or opt in right before the deadline. And that was one of the main concerns town board members had, was they were voting on something that wasn't 100% completed yet. Chris, in Ellenville, you're having something different there. You have a large warehouse of growing cannabis there. That's something we don't have here in Sullivan County coming at all. But what can you tell us about an update there? You've been talking about to us a lot here in the local edition, also here on the Reporters Roundtable about Cresco Labs. I believe there was a planning board meeting last night, I believe, right?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Cresco Labs came in with their full site plan, full application last night. And we heard all the, we've heard most of these details already. It's pretty big, pretty exciting in terms of the economic boost it might give Wawarsing and Ellenville. You know, 380,000 square foot facility, possibly as many as 400 jobs. Although we should add that they're also looking at about 750 parking spaces. So there may be more jobs down the road. Who can say? It will be a big change. And, you know, they're going to grow a lot of canopy. A lot of product will come out. The planning board seemed to be moderately in an approving mode. I don't think there were no voices in the public hearing against it. And I'll just go back to what Philip was saying. Here in Wawarsing, it was strict party line. It was, the three Republicans, no, the two Democrats, yes. And in the village of Ellenville, which is all Democrats, or at least it was then, it was just yes. You know, there was no question of any no's. I don't know. Over in Orange County, you know, Crawford and also Shawangunk, strongly Republican places, it was straight up no. So I don't know. There was a certain, we seem to see a certain kind of political alignment that way. And Rochester, town of Rochester, was also of opt-in. And one reason for opting in as opposed to opting out or not being able to opt out once you've opted in is, you know, once you've opted in, businesses will begin. And then what are you going to turn around and say to somebody who's invested $500,000 in a business? Well, I'm sorry, we had a change of one person on the town board and your business is canceled. No. That's not going to happen in New York State, I don't think. Anyway, back to Cresco Labs. There were some issues. Riverkeeper has sent in a letter, a 16-page letter, with the usual concerns you would expect from Riverkeeper, which is, of course, an environmentally-minded organization concerned about what's going into the Hudson River. We'll have to see what Cresco Labs comes back to say in terms of what their effluent will be like. You know, what are they going to put out? They are estimating about 30,000 gallons a day of effluent and about 90,000 gallons of water coming in every day. So there's 60,000 pounds to be dispersed between the atmosphere and the thousands of 9-foot tall cannabis plants growing indoors. So the other issue, which of course has come up several times, is odor. Having thousands of 9-foot tall cannabis plants growing inside somewhere means it's going to be a very strong smell. If you've ever been around growing cannabis, you know what I mean. But Cresco Labs has been doing this in a lot of different states. They're in about 10, 11 states. And they are very confident. They have carbon filtration systems. They have a whole way of, I love some of the phraseology here, trapping fugitive odors. So put that one aside. Fugitive odors is something that will be trapped. Anyway, they use carbon filtration, which they say is the state of the art. And they use something called air curtains around their loading docks and the, you know, where they have machinery doing the production of their medicinal products. So that was all, you know, they just ran through it all. And we should give a big shout out to Jonathan Lockman, the town planner, because he managed to read all the way through a 9-page EAF Part 3 without stumbling and without even a sip of water, which, you know, has got to be. I mean, that's getting up there, you know, just turning it into an Olympic event, you know, and I wouldn't like to try that. So, you know, it all seems to be going along there. Now, to go with this, I had a story last week, which I thought was kind of interesting. Another organization, much smaller, but still in the same kind of business, called Grow Generation, which is a Denver centered business, which is one of the biggies in indoor growing. Everything you want, you know, in terms of things to hide plants in, to hydroponic systems for your closet or the house or wherever, and nutrients and nutrient supply in everything from like a few ounces up to many pounds, even large quantities. They came in, they have bought a property on Route 209 just north of Ellenville, which coincidentally, and he swears it's a coincidence, is about a home runs distance, no more than that, about 500 feet from where Cresco Labs will be building their thing. So when Cresco Labs needs anything for their hydroponics, they just have to walk up the road and collect it and bring it back in wheelbarrows. I mean, it's so sweet. But it does seem to indicate that Wawarsing is going to be some kind of a little regional center for this particular industry.
Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us for another edition for the Reporters Roundtable. We were joined by Joseph Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat, Leah Mayo from the River Reporter, Chris Riley from the Shawangunk Journal, and Philip Pantuso from the River Newsroom. You were listening to the Reporters Roundtable on Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricio Rubio.
We'll take a short break, and when we come back, Catskills Pride. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on This American Life, Rob and Rainer were shopping for a house. And one day, they toured one, and it seemed perfect in every way. Till Rob spotted something in an upstairs bedroom.
All of a sudden, I hear him cussing and coming down the stairs, and he's like, "We gotta go now."
What they saw, how it changed their lives forever, and rocked an entire city this week.
Saturday at 6 on Radio Catskill.
Hi, it's Rachel Martin with NPR's Morning Edition. As you've no doubt heard, listener support makes public radio possible. But here's something you may not have heard. Public radio stations around the country raise millions of dollars each year from the sale of donated vehicles. That's right, vehicles of all sorts. Whether they're running or not, they can be turned into support for public radio. That vehicle you no longer need, here's how to donate it to support this station.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. About 60% of older Americans take a cholesterol-lowering statin to prevent heart attack, stroke, and other forms of cardiovascular disease. In contrast, only 25% of eligible HIV-negative people take PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, a safe and highly effective way to prevent HIV infection. In December, the CDC updated its clinical practice guidelines on PrEP. The major change offers the potential to give all people access to the medication, changing how healthcare providers should think about PrEP and who it's for, and it has the potential to transform the HIV epidemic in the U.S. and possibly put it in the rearview mirror. Today, the folks from Catskills Pride are here to talk about local access to PrEP and other HIV medications. Catskills Pride supports and celebrates LGBTQIA plus people and allies in the Catskills region through education and other social programs. Here's their conversation on sexual health with Catskill Pride's Brian Irwin, Dwayne Brown, and Dale Blagrove.
Hi, my name is Dale Blagrove with WJFF, and with me today I have Dwayne Brown with Catskills Pride. Dwayne is here this morning going to talk to us with Chris Bungay about PrEP.
Thanks, Dale, for having us. In keeping with our commitment to be the number one resource for all things LGBTQIA within the Catskills, Catskills Pride has teamed up with Dr. Chris Bungay to talk about sexual health and to provide some education and resources to discuss HIV as well as STI prevention. Chris, thanks for joining us this morning. And for our listening audience, could you please tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thank you, Dwayne. Thank you, Dale, for having me here. I'm a physician in New York City. I'm in private practice for the last 19 years in primary care. I do specialize in HIV and STI treatment, as well as HIV prevention, doing a lot of PrEP work in our office. And I do have a weekend home here in Bethel for the last 16 years, and I am a proud member of Catskills Pride. Thank you for having me.
So let's just jump right in there. Can you provide us with the latest stats on HIV and STIs here nationally and here in the Catskills, if possible?
I do have just the national data. And there's been HIV cases have plateaued over the last few, 3-4 years, and it's probably starting to decrease. And same thing in different parts of the New York State. But there are still a good group of people who are disproportionately affected by HIV, particularly MSM population, and especially our Black Latino MSM, and also women, Black Latino, or especially young women, are being disproportionately affected by HIV.
I took some time to go to the CDC website, and I did find some numbers. We couldn't find them specifically for the Catskills, but it was actually by region. So for the Northeast, Latino men having sex with men was like the largest, quickly followed by Black men. Why do you think this is?
Well, there are a lot of factors. There's probably some cultural taboos in some communities that some people are either not getting tested or not connected to a healthcare system. There's a big distrust in some of those communities as well with the healthcare system. So there's a lot of different factors. Some may not even identify as gay, and that's why we use the term men having sex with men.
Got it. And then in that same report, you know, the numbers that fell right behind Latino and Black men were the transgender community as well as women.
Yes, that is correct. And again, same thing. Some of those groups may have a big distrust in the current healthcare system. So we need a lot of we need to do a lot of work to serve those communities who may not be going to be reaching very well. And STIs are also climbing up. Despite the pandemic, we're still diagnosing a lot of people with sexually transmitted infection. And as we know in the medical field, STIs go along with HIV. Your chance of getting HIV is much higher if you get diagnosed with a sexually transmitted infection.
What can we do to reduce HIV infections?
Well, there are twofold the way we look at it. The most important thing is to get tested, because if you do test positive, we have a lot of great medications out there now to treat HIV. And we also know that once the virus is suppressed, the risk of passing it on to other people is a lot. The soup is very low, practically zero. And that's what we call U equals U. You might have heard the term. Mm-hmm. That means undetectable equals untransmittable. So the risk of passing the HIV virus is very low, close to zero if you are on medication. And if you do test negative and you think you're at risk for HIV, we do have other options besides condoms and behavioral changes that can help reduce your risk of HIV. And that's what we call PrEP. PrEP has been shown to be very effective in significantly reducing HIV infection. As a matter of fact, there's been studies in some areas where there is a high PrEP uptake, meaning there's a high use of PrEP in one area. When they compare it to another area where there's very low use of PrEP, there has been a significant reduction of new HIV diagnosis in those high uptake area. So it does work, and it does help prevent people from getting HIV. We do serve a lot of communities, especially we get a lot of gay men on PrEP in our office. It's been around since 2012. PrEP's been around for a long time. I've had a lot of people with on medications. And before PrEP was around, I would diagnose one or two new cases of HIV every month. And ever since we've started doing PrEP, I haven't diagnosed anybody new with HIV for the last 3 years. That's how well it works.
That is amazing. You know, it's just astounding to think that you can go from such the high numbers that we've had and someone taking PrEP to zero in that short of a time. That's amazing. So what are the different options for PrEP?
Well, a lot of people might have heard of Truvada as an option for PrEP. Now we have several options now, actually. Truvada is just one of them, and it went generic in October 2020, like over a year ago. So now it's a lot cheaper as well. And there is another oral medication called Descovy. Again, it's also taken daily like Truvada. It does have less of an effect on the kidneys and the bones. So for those patients who may be having issues with Truvada, can switch over to Descovy. And more recently, as of like less than a month ago, a new medication actually got approved for PrEP. It's called Apretude. It's an injectable treatment for PrEP that is given every 2 months at the doctor's office. It is a big injection through the buttocks, so that's why it can be given by yourself. So you have to go to see your doctor every 2 months to be on this medication. But we have a lot of patients who are young, who don't take any other daily medication. This might be very helpful for them who don't need to take a daily pill to be protected from HIV.
So let's talk about access. How easy is it to get these medications?
Well, like I said, you know, Truvada is not generic. So a lot of insurance are covering generic Truvada with no issues. And there's also what we call the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force recommendations. These are guidelines given to physicians what should be recommended to your patients and actually what should be covered by insurance companies. And PrEP has been considered a grade A recommendation, the highest recommendation. So based on the Affordable Care Act, most insurance companies should cover this medication for free without any cost. And so coverage should be fairly easy.
Okay, so what I'm hearing here is that everyone should and does have access to PrEP, whether they're insured or not?
Actually, if they don't have insurance, there are actually programs that people can enroll with. In New York State, we have a program called PrEP App, PrEP-AP. It's a New York State-based program that will cover medications, will also cover your blood tests and office visits if you meet their criteria. And it's usually income-based. If you make a certain amount of money or less, you will qualify for this program. And you're only going to be able to get the medications and the visits to specific locations throughout the state that is enrolled in this program. And also, if you do have insurance, and for some reason your insurance has a higher copay for your medication, there are copay assistance programs out there that are available, and they are sponsored by the pharmaceutical companies who make these products.
Those two, those links you just mentioned, PrEP app and PrEP locators, we can definitely make sure that those will be provided through the Catskills Pride website for resources after the show.
Great. You know, there's definitely still biases out there and our stigma associated with taking PrEP. In the beginning, when PrEP became available, there is some terminology that people give, so therefore risk of getting STIs and HIV might be higher. So there's that stigma from some of the providers. So basically, we need more education for everybody, not just for the general population, but for providers to know what it is. There are even some providers who have never heard of PrEP. PrEP's been around, like I said, since 2012, but yet some people have never heard of it. And I have patients who sometimes end up in the emergency room where they give them their list of medication and they ask them, well, you have HIV? And they're shocked to hear that they're taking an HIV medication to prevent HIV. So there's definitely a lot of education that needs to be given. And then there are patients who are concerned about side effects. And the good news about sometimes now we have options. We have ways to address some of the side effects. And we have ways to address the frequency of how often people have to take medication as well.
Thank you, Chris. That was very informative. In preparation for the, no pun intended, in prep for this talk, I went to several county websites, health department websites, to look and see who was providing PrEP. And I was quite shocked. I mean, I know we're in upstate New York, but even doing a search for HIV was left me with hardly anything to report back. I actually put in STIs or PrEP and nothing came up. For several state health departments, not state, county health departments in the Catskills. And, you know, that's really challenging to when it comes to trying to provide sexual health opportunities for the LGBTQIA community up here.
Yeah, we're very fortunate in New York City when we do have a New York Department of Health that is very proactive about this. But unfortunately, we can't say for everywhere else, not just for here, but the rest of the country where there is a lot of new HIV cases that are not being addressed. So there's a lot of work to be done. I agree.
So Chris and Dwayne, you mentioned PrEP shaming, and I want to talk a little bit about that and really, you know, what it is. And, you know, I'm willing to kind of put my experience on the line. You know, if I would meet a guy, I would look to see if he had a blue pill around because that was the original color of Truvada. So that kind of put other thoughts and ideas in my head. You know, maybe this person does get around, or, you know, I didn't want to take PrEP at first because that would give the idea that I was like that, as I was promiscuous or things like that. So yeah, there's some interesting pieces to the shaming part of it.
But I think that's definitely what it was like in the beginning. I think when it first became available, as more people didn't know about it. But I think that has changed a lot. I think the cultures have changed. The shaming is no longer there. I don't believe, at least not in New York City. A lot of people are on PrEP. So therefore, it becomes more like a norm. Actually, now is actually, I'm hearing the opposite sometimes. Some people will not have sex with somebody if they're not on PrEP. So there's definitely a cultural shift in New York City. Whether that works in other places, maybe not yet. But I think that seems to be where it's headed.
You know, it's one of those things where PrEP is not permission for unprotected sex, right? And so, and I think that's important for people to understand. Just because you're on PrEP doesn't mean you should not have unprotected sex. And, I think that may be a common thing.
And we do counsel our patients when they're on PrEP for continued safe sex, because there are other things out there that we may not even know yet. And you know, I think this is more like, this is an extra barrier as another way to prevent getting HIV. It's an additional barrier, an effective one too. So that's how I perceive PrEP rather than as a reason not to use protection, or not a reason to be promiscuous. This is an extra barrier of protection.
I think if people change the mindset a little bit and that taking PrEP is actually a way of taking care of yourself, then that really helps people, and taking it as well as having discussions around it. Right. So, it'd be great if that was something that was commonly, discussed amongst people as well as teens. So we were able to prevent things like that. So I definitely want to thank you for taking the time to spend with us and give us some more information. The more information we're able to put out there, the better. And I think particularly, I hate to say it, I think particularly up in this area, because, or having the opportunity to live in San Francisco as well as New York City is where things are saturated with information. Here, that's not the case. And so the idea that PrEP, and even today's age, is still a strange word to people, it just sometimes that leaves me a little bit bewildered. You know, one thing I do want to ask, and I'm going to hate to pick on you, Brian, a little bit, because you're a little bit more relatable to the younger mindset. And what would you think would be a great way of reaching out to them?
Of reaching out to younger LGBTQIA people?
Yeah.
I think that
aside from TikTok.
TikTok. Let's not talk about TikTok right now. But it is an effective resource because everybody's on it. That being said, I think that what my generation and the generation after me appreciate about sexual health and wellness and education is not pretending, like not making it fun, just being very clear about it, like telling us like what is happening, what are the risks, what are the dangers. Don't like come in with like balloon animals and like try and make it fun. We don't want that. That's not like, we don't need to be entertained. We just need the information. Like, we'll create our own entertainment. We'll make our own fun. Just give us the facts. And I feel like especially in high schools and all that kind of stuff, like even starting with sexual education, is that like adults find it very uncomfortable to talk to children about sex in general. And so then when it comes to anything past just normal, like heteronormative sex, it's even more, there's a whole nother barrier because they may have not ever engaged in it. They may not know anybody who's it, like the teacher doesn't know anything about it. So it's like trying to deal with that is more of a hurdle. So I think the best thing that Catskill Pride as a group can do to get the information out is just to be the resource, to provide the resource and provide the access to that information. Because growing up, I said this time and time again, I did not have these resources available to me. Like I had to find these things out on a long, difficult road. And so I think that, you know, making sure that people know that there is access to this information and that it is free and it is open and it is not like sugar-coated is good, because then, you know what is real, you know what like the facts are. And I think that that's helpful. At least it would be to me, or it would have been to me when I was that age.
Oh my good. That's like incredible. So make a great TikTok. No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead, Chris. Go ahead.
See, but TikTok's different because on TikTok you want it to be fun, but that's different. All
right. Chris, go ahead.
And I just want to add, I think there, in order to really improve this, I think in two ways, people need to be proactive with their health. I think, I think you need to kind of step up, and if you think you should be on PrEP, I think people should be proactive to research that, like Brian said. And if your physician is not comfortable prescribing, you find another physician that will feel comfortable. And then a second part of this, I think every primary care doctor should be able to prescribe this. They should be, it's very easy to prescribe PrEP, actually. It doesn't take a lot of things to learn. I think every primary care physician should be able to learn how to prescribe this and learn how to prescribe this if they're serving a population that are at risk for HIV. And I think that's just taking that extra step for physicians to do will increase the uptake of people in preventing HIV cases.
Thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciate you being here today. Chris, Brian, Dwayne. Kind of want to wrap up. I'm going to circle back to Dwayne and some of the activities that are going on with Catskills Pride.
Absolutely. So we're in the middle of a pandemic, so we offer monthly socials, but due to COVID, we've had to kind of scale back on what these monthly socials look like. So for January, we're actually doing a virtual bingo that is hosted by no other than the fabulous Miss Bell Pepper herself on January the 29th from 3 to 4:30. We have prizes provided by such places as Narrowsburg Proper, the Heron Restaurant, the Velvet Maple Lifestyle Store, and the Chi Hive Yoga Studio and Gym. We're looking forward to people joining us since we can't join in person right now. To RSVP, and you just go to catskillspride.com.
Thank you, Dwayne. We're looking so forward to that. One of the things that's really exciting about it is that even though we're not able to meet in person, it is virtual, right? So those people that want to be here and maybe can't make it up during the week, you know, an event like this is great. So you can really see what's going on from Catskills Pride during the week.
And we have dates for going into the spring, actually all the way through June. We have dates solidified for our socials by the month, but you can always go to our calendar of events.
And Dwayne, where is your calendar of social events?
It's on our website.
Yeah.
www.catskillspod.com.
This is Radio Chatskill. We'll take a short break and we'll be back with Ron Bernthal and Borders.
I dream of a city of bread and festivals, where those who don't have the bread aren't excluded from the carnival. I dream of a city in which action grows out of knowledge and understanding, where you haven't got it made until you can help others get to where you are or beyond, where I don't have to translate my expertise into jargon to impress officials and confuse citizens.
Julian Argeman on the Janice Adams Show, Saturday at noon.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. America's national forests cover over 193 million acres, and they welcome 170 million visitors each year. In the latest episode of his WJFF podcast, Borders, Ron Bernthal speaks with author Greg Peters about the Forest Service enduring mission to protect, ensure, and ensure access for all in America's forests.
To understand the national forest system and why it came about, obviously we have to go back in time to really kind of the post-Civil War era. The federal government found itself the owner, for lack of a better word, of huge tracts of land out west and was trying to figure out what it needed to do or what it wanted to do with those lands. So starting in 1876, it sent folks out to assess the extent of what they called the public domain lands, which were all of these lands in the west. One thing that they did not want to have happen, or many folks did not want to have happen to these lands, was what ended up happening to privately owned lands in the east, in the Midwest, and particularly the forest of the East and the Midwest. In the 1800s and even the 1700s, those landscapes had been pretty heavily cut over and were in pretty tough shape in the latter half of the 1800s. So policymakers, folks in the federal government, didn't necessarily want to see that happen to the West. So starting in 1891, Congress passed a law called the Forest Reserve Act, and that allowed the president to set aside lands from these public domain lands in the West as forest reserves. So that was really the first instance where we saw, aside from a few select examples like Yellowstone National Park, for example, but that law in 1891, it was really the first time that we saw presidents set aside lands in the West for public use and for preservation and conservation. Fast forward a few years, in 1905, the Forest Service is officially created, and the management of those forest reserves shifts from the Department of Interior to the Department of Agriculture through the Transfer Act, which was signed into law by President Teddy Roosevelt. So 1905, we see the Department of Agriculture start to manage the national forests under the just formed Forest Service, and that's really kind of where we get the national forest system that we have today, at least the start of it. So reforesting those lands and bringing those watersheds back to health. And again, that happened in 1911. So it wasn't too far after 1905, when the Forest Service was first actually created, that we really start to see it become a fully national organization, stretching, you know, from the east all the way across the west. And then the last really important piece is in 1937 with the Bankhead Jones Farm Tenant Act, which was a New Deal era program that was designed, again, did two things, but for our purposes, it allowed the federal government to purchase land, this time in the Great Plains, in areas where the Dust Bowl had ravaged soil fertility and was creating all sorts of problems. So the federal government, once again, was authorized to purchase lands from private landowners and restore them. And this time, instead of planting forests, they planted grasses and other vegetation. And they brought those land low hazards, they were called, they brought those back to health by getting grasses and other vegetation back established so that the soil didn't blow away. About 25 years later, in 1960, those lands were officially, or many of those lands, were officially brought into the National Forest System as national grasslands through a law in 1960. And now there are 20 national grasslands that the Forest Service manages around the country, in addition to about 155 national forests that they manage, and they're spread all across the country from Alaska all the way to Puerto Rico. So, the Eastern National Forests are, I think, a really interesting story. And again, it really stems from that restoration notion, because those high elevation watersheds were in such tough shape because of the industrial logging practices in the 1800s. The Forest Service really kind of cut its teeth in restoration by focusing its efforts in those Eastern National Forests. As far as timing goes, they came a little bit later than many of the Western forests. The Weeks Act, which allowed the federal government to purchase those lands in the East, that didn't get passed until 1911. And then, of course, you know, they couldn't just go out and say, we want to buy this tract here, you know, without any homework. So the Forest Service developed a system and various ways of assessing the land, finding a willing landowner, making sure that it actually did cover a watershed, and then purchasing that land and starting a process of reforestation. So really, that didn't, you know, probably kick into gear until later in the 1910s, into the 1920s. And it lasted up until, I think, probably for another 20 or 30 years after that, the actual acquisition of these lands. And then over time, also, you know, these smaller tracts of land were built on and they were combined. And so over time, you end up getting sort of the modern borders of those Eastern National Forests that we know today. Most of those are in Appalachia. They're in the mountains in the Appalachian Range. But they stretch all the way from Maine. There's a little corner of the White Mountain National Forest in Maine. Mostly, the forest itself is mostly in New Hampshire. Into Vermont and New York and Pennsylvania. So northern New England does have some national forests as well. And they stretch all the way down into the Deep South. Alabama and Mississippi have national forests. I think Mississippi has more than 1 million acres of national forests cumulatively, which is really quite a large amount of land. Because of the general just sort of historical ownership pattern of land in the East, our national forests really do represent some of the best public land access opportunities in the East. And so they're quite beloved. They're several hours from some of the major cities on the East Coast, but that doesn't stop people from heading out and enjoying them. You know, the Monongahela National Forest in West Virginia, the George Washington Jefferson, which is also in Virginia and West Virginia, they're incredibly popular. Probably the most popular national forests in the East are down in North Carolina outside of Asheville. The Nantahala Pisgah National Forests are a huge destination for folks across the Southeast. And of course, you know, you have the Appalachian Trail, which is managed, the trail itself is managed by the Park Service, but it cuts across a lot of national forests. And so the East would be very different without that national forest system.
That's an excerpt of Borders, the podcast from WJFF's Ron Bernthal. You can catch the full episode at wjffradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and also check out our other selection of podcasts. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Liza Phillips Design, sustainably sourced natural fiber rugs for floors and stairs, designed in Narrowsburg, handmade in Nepal. By appointment and on the web at lizaphillipsdesign.com. From Jeffersonville Bake Shop, offering breakfast and lunch to go or to stay, Tuesdays through Sundays. Also featuring Chi Hive Yoga's gentle movement class in the event space, jeffersonvillebakeshop.com.
On the next On Being, Catherine May in conversation with Michael Pollan for our series, The Future of Hope.
My fondest hope is that this medicine has arrived at a moment when we're really sick and it might help treat us. to the extent it can produce this softening of egos and increase in openness, God, what do we need more?
I'm Krista Tippett. Join us
Monday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Farming Country is coming up next. Today's forecast, sunshine, and a few clouds later, high near 24. This is WJFF Jeffersonville.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.